Yeah, I'd like to convene the Ways and Means Committee. And Representative Mariani, have you had a chance to look at the minutes?
Mr. Chair, I'd be honored to move the minutes.
Okay, that motion is before us for April the 15th. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion carried. The first bill up this morning is House File 270 by Representative Houseman. It's the capital investment bill. And I usually say welcome to the committee, but you're on the committee. So if you want to start by making a motion and then explain the bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I will move House File number 270. And I have an author's amendment to move, and I don't know if you want me to add that first and then talk about the bill or...
I think we should, because the tracking sheet that we have in the packets reflects the amendment. So why don't you move the amendment? That puts... It's a technical amendment, as I understand it.
So I would further move the A11 amendment and just briefly tell you what's in it, which is some University of Minnesota and Minsky language, all of which are primarily technical changes to make it more accurate, except for the fact that they did delete Anoka Technical College because that was no longer necessary. I'll say a little more about that later. The representative from Champlin indicated that their project can be done for $1 million less than he initially thought. And so we've decreased that, and we've added that to DNR asset preservation. On lines 113 to 115 is language, I believe, requested by Mr. Marks, which deals with the general fund appropriation language. There is on line 120, deed rider for the Mankato Arena. On line 121, Children's Museum added pre-design. And then the longest part of the bill is was a Norton amendment. It dealt with the local bridge fund, and it was added in the Transportation Committee to her bill, but because that bill was never sent to us, we didn't get that engrossment. I have checked with the people in MnDOT and some of the local governments, and am told that that is helpful language to accompany the local bridge program, and so we are adding that. There is some technical language around the Fergus Falls RTC, and on lines 326 to 335, there's a project in Minneapolis, Granary Road, that they've had some difficulty with purchase of land, and so we're extending that date somewhat. So that is the author's amendment, and we have anticipated that you might be willing to pass that by already including those items in our spreadsheet.
Okay, any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion carried. Do you represent Houseman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm going to give just a brief overview about why we want to move on a bonding bill in 2013. We believe it's an opportunity to invest in statewide infrastructure and to reduce a backlog for crumbling wastewater systems, asset preservation, local roads and bridges all over the state. It preserves assets, most significantly the 108-year-old state capitol. It completes projects that have been in queue for a long time. It takes advantage of historic low interest rates, creates temporary, permanent, and spin-off jobs that are vital to the state's continued economic recovery. We believe it makes strategic investments with a high return on those investments. We hope it looks fair to you and geographically balanced, that it treats all the state the same. There's very strong and united business community support. I'll share a couple of those letters in a bit. Well within the debt service management guidelines, continues to push us out of the recession, stretches taxpayer dollars further at a time of record low interest rates. For your information, the last bond sale had the historically low interest rate of 2.06%. There's roughly $100 million in asset preservation. The public safety projects are flood mitigation, local roads and bridges, dam repair, housing, and the largest, the St. Peter Security Hospital. Again, we believe it takes advantage of low construction bids before inflation returns. When inflation returns, all of these projects will cost significantly more. We protect natural resources in International Falls, the Voyageurs National Park, in Big Lake, the Sanitary District, in Albert Lake, Fountain Lake. In all of those areas, it makes Minnesota cleaner. Again, completes projects that are long past ready to go. In some cases, it maximizes non-state leverage, federal, local, and private. And finally, makes a big dent in the backlog for higher education, for transportation, for housing, public safety, clean water and wastewater systems, natural resources, and regional economic development. The one thing almost always said every time we talk about this isn't a bonding year. And so I've included in your packets a recent history of bonding bills. And if you would just take a look at 2005 and 2006, when Speaker Stigum was last speaker, and Dan Dorman chaired this committee. He had a big job for 2 years in a row, $886 million in 2005 and $949 million in 2006. Apparently, no one said during those 2 years that it wasn't a bonding year. I had a bit of a rocky time from 2007 to 2010. You can see special sessions and vetoes, etc. But then finally, in the last 2 years, under Speaker Zeller's leadership, in 2011 and 2012, both years we had $500 million in bonding. So I think it's helpful to see that recent history. We always take seriously the debt service guidelines established by past governors. It might be helpful, and some of you might have seen this, that in terms of comparison across the country, relative to net tax-supported debt per capita, Minnesota is 24 among all states, and among on net tax-supported debt as a percent of personal 2011 personal income, these are 2012 numbers, we are 27 in ranking. So we are by no means taking on debt beyond what other states are. We're right there in the middle or somewhat lower. As you look at that spreadsheet, you notice that, as always, roughly 25% of the bill is education, 22% is environmental-related, some of that is DNR, PFA, but I also include in that transit corridors because we know immeasurably that has an impact on the environment as well. There is almost $150 million in transportation, both for MnDOT and Met Council. 16% of the bill is related to regional economic development. 14% of the bill is the capital restoration, clearly the single largest project in the bill, $109 million. And roughly 11% is in the housing and human services. You have in your packets, because it's not reflected on the spreadsheet, the asset preservation for MnSCU, because it's a very clear statement of what $50 million gets us on campuses all over the state, and we thought that might be helpful for you. You also have in the packet a number of letters. I mentioned the strong business support for portions of this bill. One is a letter that three chambers jointly wrote, Mankato, Rochester, and St. Cloud, who have been for a number of years encouraging state participation in the strength of their regional economy through these event centers. They believe those event centers are important catalysts for growth in their regions, and they provide some estimates that show these projects will create or retain more than 2,000 jobs and result in an increase of more than $63 million in annual economic impact. That is the three chambers who give us that information. They also point out that $80 million in local matches is in place and committed. To one of those projects, Rochester, we include a letter from Mayo Clinic that was written in 2009, which tells you how long we have been working on this project. And if you look at the third paragraph, beginning today, our community, they recognize way back then that we're collectively focusing on what it means to create an integrated community. And they were beginning to have a partnership already around the concept of destination medical community with a coordinated downtown development plan. And they said in 2009, the Civic Center is an important component of that vision. And in the last paragraph, they talk about the expansion and renovation would play a pivotal role in plans for them to capitalize on a strong momentum to further position Minnesota as a national leader in healthcare, scientific research, and life science. There is another letter from the five largest local chambers of commerce in Minnesota. And they specifically call your attention to a faster build-out of transit corridors. Their letter, it comes from the St. Paul Area Chamber, the Minneapolis, Greater Minneapolis, that's Bloomington, Northeast Minneapolis, Twin West, Eden Prairie, the five largest local chambers. And they are writing to support significant bonding for transit investment this year. They give you the statistics in that letter about the public support for transit improvement. They even, at the bottom of that first page, show the increase. They say 70% of voters statewide now back using state bonding funds to move forward with Southwest LRT, one of the projects in that package, up from 61% just in 2012. So there is a change in the public's perception, and certainly there is a change in the business perception. On the second page, they again talk about business support for transit investments because our region is competing with others for jobs. They tell the story of going to Denver and Salt Lake City and seeing what was happening in Denver. I think it's important also to understand that those five largest local chambers who make that case for bonding for transit investment do that in the context of a metro economy. And this is the story of the metro economy. The seven-county metro area has a gross metro product of approximately $200 billion, making it the 13th largest metropolitan economy in the nation. It represents approximately two-thirds of the state's GDP, and its economy is larger than half the states in this country. Why do we make that case? Keeping that economic engine healthy helps the entire state. There are good things that are going to happen all over the state if we keep that economic engine going. And I think parts of this bill represent a new sense of what the economy is today. There was a Council of State Governments presentation last July in Cleveland. A speaker, Mark Breederlin from the Michigan Sea Grant Extension, made the following comparison. He talked about the old economy when high-quality physical environment was a luxury. It seemed to get in the way of attracting cost-conscious businesses. And then he talked about the new economy of today, and that is that physical and cultural amenities are key in attracting knowledge workers. That's what the business community heard in Denver. What the speaker talked about is, in the past, people followed jobs. Where's the manufacturing plant? Where are the mines, etc.? And that's where we move. But today, talented, well-educated people choose location first and then look for and create jobs. Whenever I've talked about that in speeches this last year, I always look at the audience to see how that resonates. And all the young people in the audience, when I say that, today, talented, well-educated people choose their location first and then look for or create their jobs. And I see lots of nodding yes. All of that demographic from age 24 to 36 recognize that it is a very different world. I want to say just a word about portions of the bill that aren't reflected. You've got the spreadsheet in front of you, and clearly I don't have to read line by line through that, but I would like to call attention to just a little bit of language in the bill. Because not all, mostly you can skim down the spreadsheet and see locations of things. But let me just call your attention, if you have the language in front of you, to a few pages. On pages 6 and 7, there are the specific college campuses that are referenced relative to MinSCU's system-wide science, technology, engineering, and math. And you see that Century College, Moorhead, Itasca Community College, Eveleth, you see all of the the campus is mentioned there. You see that in the system-wide classroom renovation, Century College, Inver Hills Community College, Vermilion Community College, St. Paul College, and then finally, the energy renovation and additions. The amendment removed Anoka Technical. They said that was no longer necessary. But Century College, Canby and Jackson, Itasca Community College, all of those are still in place. On page 11 of the bill, you see the specific communities mentioned under flood hazard mitigation. For the most part, those are in the priority list of the department. We have Ada, Oslo, Montevideo, Moorhead, South St. Paul, and Inver Grove Heights as communities that are eligible for this funding. On page 11, excuse me, there are of the top four dam repair projects, the first two are not ready, but we're doing three and four, the one in Blue Earth County and at the city of Champlin. And the Champlin one is where we changed the dollar amount because we were told that local government needed a little less. And then on pages 12 and 13, you see the listing of all of the trails. And they're very specific about sections of trails. And so Blazing Star Trail, Camp Ripley Veterans State Trail, Casey Jones, Cuyuna Lakes, there it's specific about Paul Bunyan State Trail, the sections that are funded, Gateway Trail, Gichigami, Glacial Lakes, Goodhue Pioneer Trail, Heartland Trail, Loose Line. I will say, specifically Heartland and Loose Line have been incredibly active here, telling the story of the local community. All the trail projects come right out of the local community, and they always link it to the economy of their area. And I think the story was probably best told early on in Lanesboro, but every other community is feeling that same impact. And then, of course, the Milltowns Trail and the Minnesota River Trail between Mankato and St. Peter for specifics that you might not see on the spreadsheet. Something else you won't see on the spreadsheet on page 20 and 21, Greater Minnesota Transit. The projects that this will fund are a project in Mankato, bus garages in Elbow Lake, Morris, Wheaton, Lowry, and Alexandria, a project in St. Cloud, and a project in Kandiyohi, in the bus storage garage. Also on page 21, we've been gradually building a public railroad, Minnesota Valley Regional Railroad, that all of those communities along there will tell you the story. When the state partners in infrastructure, it builds business along the line. And people in that area can tell you that story in a compelling way. In our committee, we did have some people who asked about local match. We're providing a little bit of gentle language that says before seeking appropriations in the future, the authority must seek local contributions from the member counties. We leave that somewhat soft so they can see how that might be possible. On page 23, you see all of the eligible corridors for that $50 million in that our five largest chambers are encouraging support of. There are projects on both the West Metro and East Metro that are eligible projects for this. A variety of modes. Some of these are bus corridors, as Snelling is, and others are streetcar, as Nicollet Avenue is. So we know we're going to begin to look at a few more modes. On page 27, there's a project you might not recognize unless you've been part of bonding for a long time, and that is something called Remembering with Dignity. And for a number of years, we have been gradually putting grave markers for unmarked graves on public land of deceased residents of state hospitals. That's been an ongoing project. This year, we put in the amount that they can only do so many of them a year, and this is the amount that gets that done. On page 28, you see the asset preservation in Veterans Affairs. There is an amount for the Fergus Falls Veterans Home, for the Hastings Veterans Home, for Luverne, Minneapolis, Silver Bay, and Little Falls. And finally, members, on page 69, there is a repealer. Last year, you may recall, a very long program that was put into law that suggested Deed would make some choices after we adjourned. And it was sort of, we put an amount in there and said, go forth and do good things with state bond funds. That turned out to be a very controversial thing, and I think we imposed a responsibility on Deed that that they did not particularly want. I think it's important for us to be willing to debate the priorities, and so we have repealed that language. There is more money in local roads than we have been putting in, and I just wanted to say a word about that. Local bridges have been done for a long time now, and so that's a very established, and on the floor, when we bring this bill to the floor, we'll actually hand you a list of all the local bridges that are on that list, and you can actually see priorities. Because we haven't funded local roads in the same way, that's not as established, and so I think I just want to make clear to transportation people who might be interested that the funding for the local road improvement program references the statute that created the local road improvement program, which requires the establishment of an advisory committee. And so we're assuming that MnDOT, for all funds not specifically appropriated by the legislature, should consult with the advisory committee. I understand that committee has met in the past to discuss use of previous funds, and we assume that will continue. Probably the thing that that may have more conversation than most is something that's not in the bill, and that is $54 million for the Minneapolis Veterans Home. I'm hoping in the interim, I've talked to the speaker, and I believe the speaker will appoint an interim task force that will work on this. We have 874 veterans on a waiting list. When I talk to my Ramsey County Veterans Officer, she says she spends most of her time looking for temporary housing, trying to help families look for temporary housing for veterans who are on a waiting list that's 8 to 12 months long. And in some cases, these are veterans with dementia who require fairly immediate care and families who need immediate care. The request that was coming from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs was $54 million for the Minneapolis home. When we did the study on what had been invested there so far, since 1989, over $50 million. If we added another $54 million, we'd be talking about over $100 million of investment in one location. And all of our requests for homes from Representative Davids, from Representative Norton, from Representative Ward, from Representative Purcell, there's a desire to be more broadly represented. So we're hoping that Representative Huntley and others will engage in an interim conversation on decentralizing. If veterans want to stay in their homes, is there a way that are there barriers to that? If veterans want to stay in their community nursing home, are there barriers to that? And would we do better to have smaller homes around the state? If you visited the Fergus Falls home, I have always been particularly impressed with the feel that has of home. So we're encouraging more work on that. We have funded the asset preservation at all of the homes for this year. I think, Mr. Chair, that's probably, if there are questions, I think I would stop there. There are other projects I could talk about, but maybe we'll...
Okay, we'll take time then for discussion. Any questions or comments by committee members? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hausman, one of the things that we're going to be looking at, not just this year and next year and the budget of where we are, but also where we are with capacity for the state of Minnesota to accrue more debt. And I was wondering if you might want to just... walk through where we are with our accrued debt and maybe some of the changes that have taken place recently with how we basically think about our debt. I think about it like a credit card, of what our max is and where we are with that, and what kind of what goes on the credit card and how that's changed over the last couple of years, with how we look at debt and where we are, and maybe want to, Deb or Andrew might want to just kind of give us a quick snapshot of that.
Yes. Way back when Governor Perpich was governor, there was a guideline almost haphazardly determined, I'm told, in a corridor out of New York City when they were ready to go in to talk to the bond council. And they said, well, we probably should have a guideline. And they decided on 3% of the general fund, 3% of the general fund. And for a very long time, that is what we used. But what we were told by the rating agencies is that isn't a very helpful guideline, because general funds in state from state to state are vastly different. What do we include in the general fund? It wasn't a good measure. And so when Governor Pawlenty took a look at this, he devised not just one guideline, but several of them. And he measured against percent of personal income, because that is something you can compare from state to state. And so he had a number of guidelines, and one of them, and I think most significant to me and the one that gives me most heartburn, is the one that said, I want to quantify all debt. Now, that meant geo bonding, but it also meant trunk highway bonding. It also meant MHFA nonprofit housing. It also meant the University of Minnesota, when we allowed them to do the football stadium and the research buildings. And then in the last year or two, we really got heavy, and we did the tobacco securitization bond, and all that debt went on the spreadsheet. And then we did the Viking Stadium, and that debt went on the spreadsheet. Now, you can argue that we haven't let all those bonds, but the point is, one of those guidelines says, when they're authorized, even if they're not issued. When the Mayo project came forward, as someone who is concerned about all the state, all the parts of the state, and all the sectors, from higher education to transportation, another huge amount of appropriation that would go on that spreadsheet would begin to put us perilously close to affecting geo bonding, and all of the people around the state who have an interest in the state partnering on the projects you see before you, I think if they understood this, would also have some concern. So I do think that as the state moves forward, that whenever we talk about taking on or allowing someone to use a huge amount of our debt capacity, we should always think about it in relation to this. And I think for the Ways and Means Committee, that's probably an important component of the discussion. Now we're still within guidelines.
Representative Houseman and Representative Dean, we have the spreadsheet in our packet. We could have Mr. Lee, if you'd like, either of you to walk us through it as a follow-up or an answer on your question, Representative Dean. Looks like he's ready and able. Mr. Lee.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Andrew Lee, House Fiscal Staff. The spreadsheet that has 4/15/2013 Minnesota House Capital Investment General Fund account shows the debt service on geo bonding, which also includes trunk highway bonds, and all capital projects and grants, and it shows the change items that both the governor's proposal and this bonding proposal. If you look on the far left-hand column under the current biennium, you'll see at the total capital investment committee the total spending for debt service and capital projects on line 22 is $459 million. That is artificially low because in 2011, when the tobacco securitization bonds plugged a general fund hole, all of that money went to pay debt service. And so if you look on line 4, that's the result of that, the $635 million. And so if you add that back in, the total capital projects and geodet service for the current biennium is $1.09 billion. Then in the base budget, which estimates a $225 million bonding bill, and typically MMB estimates how many bonds will be issued based on historical precedent, and so they assume a $225 million bonding bill in budget in even years, and or sorry, in odd years, and then a $775 in even years. Those numbers vary, but that's what they use to estimate the number of bonds that will be coming online and be sold. So the base budget shows the appropriation bonds for the U of M Stadium, Biomedical Research Facility, Housing Finance Agency, the state appropriation refinancing bonds on line 15. That's the mechanism or the debt service of paying back the tobacco securitization bonds. And on line 16 is the Viking Stadium debt service for the both the city's and the state's share. So that's not in relation to how that money is raised. That's just the debt service on that. So in the far right-hand box, this shows the debt service, and in the change items are in italics for House File 270. And on line 22, the total amount for the 14-15 biennium is the target number for this committee. So that's in terms of debt service. Now in terms of the guidelines, there's two guidelines. Guideline 2 is all issued, authorized debt that is either being paid or is waiting to be paid on. So the Viking Stadium, for example, is currently in Guideline 2, even though the bonds haven't been let yet, and there isn't any debt service being paid on it yet. Once the bonds are issued, and that is issued not by the legislature, but when MMB sees that there's a cash flow need, then it moves into Guideline 1. And Guideline 1 is 3.25% of state personal income, so that's everyone's income in the state of Minnesota combined times 0.0325. And currently we have $1.3 billion in capacity in Guideline 1. And $3.5 billion in capacity for Guideline 2.
Could you repeat that? Was it?
Sorry. The
3.2?
$3.5 billion in capacity for Guideline 2. So that's all issued or unauthorized and the bonds that we're currently paying debt service.
Okay. Any questions of Mr. Lee? Representative Dean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lee, how much money do we owe right now as a state? I don't see it on the spreadsheet. Isn't it about $6 billion or something like that?
Currently outstanding, the bonds that have been authorized and are, that we're paying on is $6.8
billion. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Lee. And so when you say that we have 1.3 in capacity for Guideline 1, does that assume that assumes that some of that will jump from Guideline 2 to Guideline 1 within the current year? Is that correct?
Correct.
And Mr. Chair, I think the other piece that's important to say is we are constantly repaying to the tune of about $300 million a year or a biennium?
A year.
So $300 million a year we're paying off. So that's a changing figure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Lee, yeah, we're going to have about 300 fall off. A bunch will jump up from Guideline 2 to Guideline 1, but I think it's important for members to understand that the tobacco securitization does show up on our credit card, as does the Viking Stadium, as Representative Hausman brought up, and that is kind of a dynamic number that's moving, that basically is on our credit card, and that we need to pay attention to. Mr. Chair, last question just for Representative Hausman. Do you have a plan for when this would, assuming it passes and gets to the House floor, of when that might take place in relation to the tax bill, Representative Huntley's bill, and other finance bills, of when we might be expecting to see this on the floor?
Representative
Hausman. Mr. Chair. I don't. That's out of my hands. My understanding is that all of the budget bills are to go first. In fact, I think I was when we first got our schedule, I was among the last that was supposed to come here. But I think we were maybe a little more efficient in our committee or something and moved more quickly and got here faster. But I think the I think the idea is that budget bills will be moving forward, so there is no date for us. And as you know, there's a lot of conversation that has to go on around the bill.
Okay, any further questions of Mr. Lee? Thank you, Mr. Lee. Any further discussion on the bill? Well, seeing none, and Representative Hausman renews her motion that House File 270, first engrossment as amended, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. Representative Hausman, you have the next bill on the agenda as well, so being that we're moving ahead rather rapidly with our drive down the road, why don't we take this one?
We're driving down the road with a vehicle bill on House File number 1070. I will move House File 1070. We're often advised to be prepared for unexpected outcomes. I have never had to use one of these. And I'm told, Mr. Chair, that I need to make a technical amendment. This is, again, Mr. Mark's language on 222 to 227 has a blank, and I'm told that that amount is supposed to be 2.59, and I would include, do I need to make a separate motion to amend, Mr. Chair, or how would you like?
That would be a technical amendment that you're moving, and that would be 2.5 million.
2.59?
2.59 million. 2.59 million.
I would move that technical amendment.
So any discussion on the amendment that Representative Hausman has just moved? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carried. Representative Hausman, as you mentioned, the main purpose of this bill, and she mentioned she's never used one, I can say that I have. But they are used rarely, but both caucuses have historically had some bills well placed, and that's the purpose of this one. So any discussion? Hearing none, then Representative Hausman renews her motion that House File 1070, first engrossment as amended, be recommended to pass and placed in the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, and we'll now go to the transportation bill, and that will be Representative Earhart. And Representative Hornstein, Representative Earhart is not on the committee, so would you care to move
yes.
the bill to put it before us?
I'd like to move,
1416.
House File 1416. Recommend to pass and go to the general register, correct?
Okay, that's correct. Motion is before us. Now, Representative Earhart, there are some amendments. Do you want to take the amendments first?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I think that would be a good idea.
Okay, the first amendment is the A-20. Again, Representative Ornstein, being that your background is transportation in parts.
Sure. I'd like to move the H1416A20 amendment.
Okay, that motion is before us. Representative Earhart on the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This is an effort to extend the sunset on municipal authority to provide snow removal in uncompleted subdivisions. It extends by 1 year the language that allows cities to provide snow removal service in partially developed subdivisions. It passed the legislature in 2009, and when the developers were leaving large expanses of undeveloped property, partially developed, and so forth, and the municipalities wanted the right to plow those streets so they were accessible for public safety vehicles and school buses and so forth. When the bill passed, the author agreed to a sunset of 2013, but they're asking for a one-year extension at this time. The League of Cities is asking for the extension of the sunset to give this an opportunity to be thoroughly vetted in a committee next year. The League has talked with the Builders Association of Minnesota, and they have not expressed objections to the amendment. Are there questions?
Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carried. The next amendment is the A21, and I'm told Representative Beard, is that one that you've been working on?
It is, Mr. Chair. I do have two amendments. This is the fun one.
Okay. So we'll take the A21 first, and then I think the other one you've got is A22. We'll take that up later.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members, the good work the legislature did over the last couple of years included having MnDOT partner with several other non-governmental organizations to do a freight rail economic development study, particularly to help quantify the impact that the short lines and regionals have on our rural economy and how we at least can avoid policies that might hinder that or damage that relationship and that impact on rural Minnesota. Beyond that, the economic development study that they're working on is they're trying to do good work. It's a little more involved than they thought it was going to be, and so the amendment merely moves the completion date that's required from September of this year to November 15th, which would allow them to have a little more dwell time on some of the work they're trying to do, and that's the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carried. Now we have the A19 amendment by Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to move the A19 amendment.
Okay, the motion is before us. Representative Mahoney.
Sure, Mr. Chair, this just deletes the section 55 on page 35 about autonomous vehicles. The Department of Transportation, this section calls for a conversation and process of talking with the department about about autonomous vehicles. Apparently, the department thinks that you have to call in multiple groups to have that particular conversation, and they put a $200,000 cost to that conversation. I think I'll just have the conversations without them, Mr. Chair, so I don't really need this.
Okay, so the motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carried. The A22 amendment, that's the other one you were talking about, then, Representative Beard.
It is. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the A22 amendment.
Okay, the A22 amendment has been moved. Representative Beard.
Mr. Chair, the purpose of the amendment is to bring, I think, a little bit of, much like Google was just asking for in the previous amendment. You know, there's things going on with autonomous vehicles. They're already establishing a pilot program in California. They say, give us 2 years to run it here, and then we'll tell you how it's doing in this location before we move it out to the rest of the country. That's sort of the same principle behind the A22 amendment. In transportation policy, we've had lengthy discussions about mixing bicycle traffic with automobile traffic. Some of the cities in Minnesota have actually begun to take traffic lanes away and convert them to bicycle lanes, and then, of course, rewrite traffic law to try to create the impression that bicycles have the same rights and responsibilities on the road as automobiles do. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to step aside for a moment and talk about something called Toward Zero Deaths, an initiative that's been around for 10 or 12 years now with MnDOT, Public Safety, and several other interested parties. They have done a fantastic job of helping coordinate different agencies with the driving public to actually drive annual automobile deaths or auto-related deaths in this state from more than 630 a year back as recently as year 2000 down to well under 400 this last year. We're probably on a trajectory to be under 350. These are great trend lines. But, Mr. Chairman, that response relies a lot on rational and common sense thought by traffic engineers, people who study human interaction with other situations, including traffic signals, what's going on the road around them, and so on. And my fear is that what we've done with bicycle language in this bill has gone completely opposite or cross-grain to what they're trying to do in Towards Zero Deaths. I'm going to give you just a little background here, and I'll wrap up in just a couple minutes, Mr. Chair, and stand for questions. But when you've been around things that move and float and fly for years, you understand that over the centuries, certain rights of way, rules of the road, have come into play, and they come there for very tangible reasons. For instance, in the aviation world, things like balloons have right of way over everything else. My airplane has to yield to people skydiving, for instance, because skydivers have very little control over which way they're going except down, where people that are more nimble and can control themselves in three axes, like my airplane, have to yield to skydivers. Oh, by the way, skydivers have to yield to balloons because balloons move, even though they move in three axes, they move much more slowly and they're much more cumbersome. The same rules apply on the open ocean. The bigger the ship, the more right of way you have. If you're in a motorboat and a barge is coming up the Minnesota River, you better yield the right of way to the barge. That's just a matter of fact, folks. On the highway traffic, where highways intersect with trains, trains are much less nimble, much less control over different axes they move in. So guess who yields to the trains? The highway traffic always yields to the trains. In this case, though, we're running completely counter to that common sense approach to the rules of the road, and we're trying to mix 40-pound bicycles with 3,000-pound machines and expecting that the outcome will be a good thing. And so what we've done now is we've written the language as such that if you're turning right in an automobile and are overtaken and struck by a bicycle coming from behind you, the vehicle is now at fault. The automobile is at fault. I'm having a real issue with this. Many of us are. Beyond the fact that bicycles, oh, by the way, if you violate these laws and you're in an automobile, the police officer can ask you for your insurance, your registration, and your driver's license and cite you with a petty misdemeanor. That's how we're going to help educate the automobile driver to the fact that bicycles are now being asserting their equal rights to rules of the road. However, we can't do the same thing to a bicyclist. There is no insurance. There is no registration. There's no requirement to be licensed. So the educational technique, meaning pain inflicted by writing them a ticket north of $100, is not the same for somebody on a bicycle as it is for somebody in an automobile. That's another issue that we're having trouble for. So what the amendment does is basically carve out, much as Google has carved out California on the autonomous vehicles, we're saying let's carve out, in effect, the city of Minneapolis, and let's let them run with this language for a couple of years and see how that works. Let's see if the drivers get any smarter, if the bicyclists are educated to try to share the responsibility of driving in bike lanes and accommodating auto traffic as well before we afflict the rest of the state with this this idea that I think doesn't meet the common sense test. So, Mr. Chairman, that's the thinking behind the amendment. I had this expression of thought in the Transportation Policy and Finance Committee. We'll probably make the same case again on the floor if this amendment does not prevail here today. But I think this is so important in maintaining our Towards Zero Deaths initiative and maintaining fair play on the rules of the road that let's limit the damage, in my opinion, to the city of Minneapolis and see how it goes. If it's a good idea, I'm willing to stand down and say let's do the rest of the state. If it's not, we haven't afflicted people in Warroad and Worthington with the same thinking that's apparently going on in Minneapolis right now.
Okay, any discussion on the amendment? Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, this is not a very good amendment. The first thing it does is it violates the rules of common sense. And it also violates the rest of our bicycle and vehicle regulation laws without changing them, which says that the bicycle has the same rights and responsibilities of a vehicle on the road, except where it doesn't make any sense. This deals specifically with an accident that I have almost had about three times. Once, each time I managed to avoid it by, in other words, I'm riding where I'm supposed to be in a either in a bicycle lane or next to the road, and a car comes behind me and turns in front of me. Once I avoided them, I actually having my hand, as I was turning with it, had my hand on the side of the car so that I wouldn't go down as I turned around. One of the problems that we've slightly had is the mispainting of lanes, which is now being fixed up in many places. Problem that you'll have, and I have in my, almost in my neighborhood, but in the Dinkytown area, there's an intersection where one is painted right and the other one is painted wrong. Bicycle lanes should always be painted with a dashing at the end of the intersection or a dashing just before the end so that the automobile knows it's supposed to go into that lane to make a right turn. I tried to explain this to Representative Beard and tried to tell him that all he had to do was thinking of the bicycle lane as a very narrow driving lane, and then it completely makes sense. You do not, if there's a car in that lane, you don't cross in front of it, and you don't do it. His solution, first of all, violates another section of Minnesota statutes, and I'm sorry, I would, next place as this appears, I will have all of these, which says that we need to have uniform traffic laws throughout the state. And I know at least in one place where Minneapolis tried to have a separate ordinance requiring bicycles to use a trail where it existed, that was thrown out in court, because it violates this very sensible rule that you have to have the same law throughout the state. What this does is just make it impossible for people to know where they are, what they're supposed to do, and so forth. And it's just absolutely against the sense in terms of making bikes and cars relate together on the road, which means to say they have to be aware of each other, they have to follow rules that make sense, and a rule that makes sense is that when you're making a right turn, and again, if you think of the bicycle lane as a very narrow driving lane, you are as close to the curb as possible before you make that turn, and there's no room for a bicycle to go there. And for the bicyclists, the common sense thing is that when there is a car in that lane turning, you don't go there. Of course, it's also a common sense thing that if the car isn't in that lane, you don't go there earlier. You don't go there either, even if you have the right to do it. Using Representative Beard's arguments of maritime law, I was actually very, very long time ago, I think when I was a graduate student, sailing with some friends off the coast of Maine, and we were in this sailboat tacking in one of these very narrow channels, and two men and two women. The other woman, my friend, got up and is standing at the front of the boat yelling at this big, sick boat. We're in a sailboat, so we have the least tacking against the wind. We have the least maneuverability, yelling, "A sailboat tacking against the wind has the right of way against all vehicles." The two guys with us immediately took the rudder and I was standing with her, but the two guys with us immediately took the rudder and moved to the side, showing that at some point common sense is a good idea when you deal with these things. But we did know the maritime laws, and she and I were determined, I was a scientist then, not a politician, but we were both determined that we had our right to them. But as I said, common sense overtook it. So sometimes that's probably why I'm here today, to counteract the story. But sometimes one of the common senses is that you need the same laws throughout the state, and we specifically have a law that says that you have to do that. So, and this does not cover that at all. So I would urge that we vote against this amendment. This was worked on by not only the Bicycle Committee in the city of Minneapolis and St. Paul, but also the statewide Bicycle Coalition. And they have a lot more experience riding bicycles in traffic than either me or certainly you. So
we have.
I would suggest we vote against the amendment.
We have two other people on the list, Representative Beard. Did you want to respond now, or did you want to wait until they
Let's wait. Take them in order. That's fine, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Beard, there isn't a bubble around Minneapolis and St. Paul. People drive in and out of the cities from the suburbs. We also ride bikes in and out of the city and into the suburbs. In fact, I'm out there a lot biking in the suburbs. By the way, your amendment creates confusion, as the chair knows, on a bicycle path or a road I use almost all the time in the summer, which is between Robbinsdale and Minneapolis, and how would that be defined if we did this? Since the I'm not sure which it would be, which has priority on the middle of the drive, and maybe the chair knows that from past having to look it up. But
that's an interesting point. I have to continually remind you, Representative Mullery, that most of that roadway is in Robbinsdale when I used to represent Robbinsdale.
Mr. Chair, that's true, but Minneapolis regulates it and does
I understand
and
yeah.
does everything. So I'm not sure how this would fit into
we can
that.
We thank Minneapolis for the maintenance of the drive in Robbinsdale.
Poor Robbinsdale. But anyhow, it just makes no sense to exclude, just put a bubble around two cities and have different rules there. We drive in and out, we ride bicycles in and out. And it would create huge confusion.
Okay, Representative Nornes is next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess at this point I'm speaking in support of the amendment. Just a question or a comment, I guess, to the author of the actual transportation bill, Representative. I'm glad, I guess, to see bicycles as a part of this, but I would really be happy if we had some mini trucks involved in this legislation. Because they come with seat belts and all of the safety features that bicycles do not have. And I can't remember a single accident involving a mini truck. So I just, and I was tempted to have an amendment for today's committee, but I will keep working with you.
Mr. Maybe Chairman and Representative Nornes, I did suggest to you several times that you needed to get your work done, and we'd be happy to look at that problem again.
Mr. Chair, I thought a hearing at your committee was all I needed to do, but I'll take your advice.
Okay, Representative Beard.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of concluding comments. Yes, Representative Kahn, you could have the right-of-way and be dead right about it. I mean, that's something that came out of the Traffic Highway Department years ago, particularly after we started to assert the rights of pedestrians. Remember, Florida kind of led the way with that, with saying if a pedestrian's in a crosswalk, they have the right-of-way over an automobile, and immediately the number of people killed and maimed in Florida spiked because pedestrians began asserting those rights, flying in the face of common sense. Until the traffic, the automobile people were, persuaded that there was all probably jail time involved if you hit a pedestrian in a crosswalk. But sometimes we enforce these things because they seem like a good idea, and they do fly in the face of common sense. Traffic engineers will tell you that speed doesn't kill members, speed differential kills. In this case, we're mixing traffic types that are many times in difference in size and speed and capacity. And I know that this is an effort to educate the motoring public and hopefully the bicycling public, that whenever you see that dotted line, you can assert your rights to be there if you want to, but there could be dire consequences if you do. Mr. Chairman, there is uneven enforcement as well. I'd just like to point that out to the committee, that if there is an altercation on a right turn, the automobile people could probably better call their lawyer right after they call the cops. because they're going to be the ones that are going to be at fault. The bicyclists will never get a ticket because of anything that happens here, because, again, there is nothing to ticket because they do not pay for the streets or the lanes. Mr. Chairman, with that, I guess I'll conclude my remarks. I'll let the amendment stand or fall in the will of the committee. But I did want to point out that we are setting ourselves up here, because I have a hunch the amendment will not prevail. We are setting ourselves up here to see a rise, a spike, I'm sorry to say, in traffic incidents where we have altercations between automobiles and bicycles. I hope it goes the other way. Eventually it will. But, Mr. Chairman, with that, I'll conclude my remarks.
And Representative Hare, do you have a comment?
Well,
it is your bill.
Mr. Chairman, you, Representative Beard, you just mentioned uniformity as in the speed affair across the state, and that's exactly why MnDOT likes to see uniformity across the state in the various components, whether it be a school zone or your city at 30 miles an hour or what have you. And that's what I think we're suggesting here. There should be uniformity so people get used to what the law is, and they're able to perform within that law.
Okay, any, I think we're about ready to vote. Any further discussion?
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
I just want to point out this is not a change in law, it's merely a clarification of the law.
Okay, any further discussion? Seeing none, then, all in favor of the Beard Amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No. No.
Motion defeated. And we now have the bill before us. Representative Horrence, we should touch on the bill a little bit. We dealt with the amendments. You know, it's no longer a fiscal bill after the amendment number 19 went on by Representative Mahoney. It's all policy, but do you want to make a couple of quick comments before we report it out?
Well, Mr. Chairman, this is potpourri of various and sundry that we've gathered along the way. The moss is all about us, and we put it on the rock, and we're ready to go ahead.
Okay. Any further discussion on the bill? Seeing none, then, Representative Hornstein renews his motion that House File 1416, second engrossment, as amended, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. No, seeing no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. Members, we meet tomorrow, Wednesday at 10 a.m. in room 200, which will be the room that we generally meet in. Anything else that we should announce before we break? Ms. Connolly reminds me that I will be making an announcement on the floor before we break for recess tomorrow, because we go into session at 9. Okay. So we'll make an announcement on the floor, but at this point we'll plan at 10 a.m., and then if that changes, we'll make an announcement on the floor, I think is what Ms. Connolly was reminding me of.
Mr. Chair, if you would allow me to check with our leaders, because we were told we were going to caucus for a while after we break, so I don't know what time frame that will require. So
plans, if I'm not mistaken, so... but we'll make an announcement when we convene. It probably won't be at 10 o'clock if, with the caucuses taking place. So the important thing is we got the room reserved at 10. The important thing is the announcement on the floor, plus probably an email. Representative Beard.
Mr. Chair, I'll just give a heads up for the committee. There is a legislative audit commission, a full commission meeting scheduled tomorrow, I think at 9:30. It should be brief, or whenever we recess. We have some business to conduct at Legislative Audit, and I think there are several members of that commission that are on this. But we'll be over directly. I think I'll be running the meeting, and we won't stay long.
Okay, and that's what we're dealing with for a while, taxes. I don't know if taxes is still meeting as we speak, but they were meeting this morning while we started as well. So there's a lot of things going on. Okay, with that, then, meeting adjourned.
Thank you.